Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. I'm Reuben Stern. Over the past 30 years, the cost of getting a college degree has increased by about as much as 12-fold, according to Bloomberg News. That's much more than the increase in the cost of food, retail goods, or even healthcare. Here in Missouri, the numbers are less extreme since state law caps tuition increases at public four-year colleges, but tuition is only part of the cost of a college education. And of course, even a moderate increase is still an increase. So why is it exactly that while televisions and computers and all sorts of other goods eventually get cheaper over time, the cost of a college education seems to be something that never goes down in price? Today, we're going to look more closely at the microeconomics of university finances and get a better sense of why a college education costs as much as it does. We'll also look at what prevents it from getting less expensive. Our guest today, first, Nikki Krawitz, is the Vice President for Finance and Administration at the University of Missouri System. In that position, she oversees the multi-billion-dollar budget of the four-campus system. Welcome, Nikki Krawitz.
Thank you.
Glad to have you in our studio today.
I'm delighted to be here.
Also with us today, Tim Rooney is the former budget director of MU. He held the position from 2002 until his retirement last year. Welcome to our program, Tim Rooney.
Great to be here.
Glad to have you with us as well.
Thanks.
Finally with us today, Terry Donaldson is the assistant vice president for enrollment management at Columbia College. Welcome to our program, Terry Donaldson.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us as well. We hope that those of you in our audience will also join our conversation. How have rising college costs affected you, and what do you think could be done about it? We'd love to hear your ideas. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And just a reminder, our program is recorded on Mondays from 2 to 3. That's the time to call in. I want to start, Nikki, with you and this question. We'll kind of go around the table on this. First of all, help us understand this. What are the major factors that determine the cost of a college education?
Well, let me focus in particular on public higher education because, first of all, that's what I know best. And I think it's also what is supposed to be most accessible to students and their families. And the biggest driver of the increase in the cost to students and their families for public higher education has been the decrease in state support over the years. So if you look at the last 30 years history and even the last 10 years, what you would see is that higher education, public higher education, has only increased tuition more than inflation when state support has been reduced. And so the University of Missouri, for example, is operating today with 18,000 more students and less state support in total than we received back in 2001. And so that the state support per student has gone from about 10,500 to about 6,500. And so the difference in that amount of state support has to be made up in some way. And so in part it's being made up by the increase in tuition. That's the largest single driver for the increase in the cost in public higher education.
Interesting. Terry, how is it for private colleges? Why are their costs going up? Is there a simple thing to point to like that?
Well, I think costs, like you said, continually go up in higher ed, and we haven't seen anything go down. But there is no subsidy, I'll use the word subsidy, that you receive from the state or the federal governments for the institution. So when you have to figure in all your costs, whether it be faculty things, increasing infrastructure, adding technology in all the time. I mean, just to stay competitive in this environment, which is a very competitive environment, and with the private schools, we operate a very large online program, and the competitiveness for an online program is extensive across the whole nation. And so to stay competitive, increase marketing, those kind of things. So I think probably the marketing dollars, the faculty cost, and the technology costs to stay up with it.
Right. Tim, maybe you can help us with a little bit of the breakdown there. So when we look at an individual university, public institution's budget, what's the biggest share of that in terms of what what's being paid for when a student pays tuition?
Well, it's going to be salaries, is, you know, in your operating budget, faculty and staff salaries, and there are some other salaries in there. But, you know, one of the things that we need to – that ought to be clear, at least we try to make it clear, is that the tuition and the operating costs are for the general instruction. It's for the general operating budget. It's where teaching goes on and basic research and all that. Costs for other things like athletics don't come from the tuition and don't come from the state. That's a separate – at least here it's separate. The rec center, which we have, is very nice, and the residence halls and the dining halls. It's all part of the cost that students pay. I get that. But it is that we don't subsidize those areas from the state funding or from the tuition. And so I think it's important to think about that as well.
Right. And do you have a sense of how much those things have increased in the time that MU's tuition has been held?
They've increased a lot.
Moderate level of increase?
They've increased a lot. Our budget is at MU is a little better than $2 billion. And it's grown. I don't remember the numbers from like 10 years ago. It's grown a lot, and most of that growth really has been outside the operating budget for the most part. But it's a matter of competition, of marketing what you have, of what students want when they go to a four-year school, the type of experience they want, whether it's a rec center or modern residence halls. Dining halls that sort of emulate restaurants. In fact, I would suggest that a couple of our dining halls here are among the best restaurants in town. And so, you know, we are competing in the marketplace. And, in fact, we're competing in a broader marketplace right now because the number of Missouri high school graduates is declining, which is causing us to want to go outside the borders of the state for recruitment of students to maintain our enrollment, which maintains the tuition dollars, which sustains the school.
It's part of the competition for students in higher education. So whether a student goes to a public institution or a private institution, picks one over the other, is based on whether that institution satisfies the lifestyle needs as well as the academic needs of those students.
And how important are those lifestyle needs compared to the quality of instruction these days?
You'd probably be better off to ask the students.
let me ask you that, Terry, because you deal with these enrollment-type questions.
Sure.
How important is that?
I think it's very important for, I mean, if you look at Columbia College, we've got probably 95% of our students are what we would call non-traditional adult learners. So what they're after is not the college experience. They're after the academic experience, the classroom experience. So for them, being in the classroom is college for them. The other 5% is what we would have here in the local area at our main campus just down the road. Those students are looking for that in college experience. So that is the dorm life, the athletics, the things that come with being in College Town USA, those kinds of things. And that's what we market to those students. And the academics is extremely important. And you know, we would stack our faculty up against any faculty. They're high quality, so it's you get quality academics, and then they're looking for the college experience. And that same academics is given out nationwide. So we're talking about 35 campuses around the country. So
right. It's not a mutually exclusive issue for sure.
Of course.
I mean, they're you know, our students are looking for a rich academic experience, but they're also looking for a rich social experience. They're at the age these are traditional students, not non-traditional mm-hmm. students. And so they are at an age where they are looking for a quality social experience as well. And that's what some of those outside the academic area, that's some of the things that we try to bring to the table right. for them.
I want to come back to that in a second. First, I need to remind everyone that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking about why college costs continue to rise. Joining me in the studio are Nikki Krawitz, Vice President for Finance and Administration at the University of Missouri System, Tim Rooney, former Budget Director at MU, and Terry Donaldson, Assistant Vice President for Enrollment Management at Columbia College. For those of you in our audience, are there ways you think the cost of college could be lowered or at least kept better under control? Share your ideas by giving us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection Conversations take place live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can be part of our conversation at that time and watch our video feed by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. The social experience that college students are paying for, you know, some of what is increasing the cost of those amenities are private dorm rooms, private bathrooms, less of that communal interaction. How is that working out in terms of students getting a much more comfortable living situation, and yet they're paying for this kind of social experience where they learn a lot of things outside the classroom?
Well,
I was in college, I had a roommate and we shared a bathroom with about 20 or 30 other people, and we had a lot more interaction.
But you couldn't wait to get out after your freshman year, typically, is what happened. Uh-huh. And what we're seeing now is that sophomores and juniors are wanting to remain in the residence halls. And there's good data that shows that students that live on campus and students that work on campus, also data for that, do better academically. And we have what we call freshman interest groups in the freshman year, where we group them based on a particular academic theme, and they live together and they go to several classes together. And so they build a social network through the academic area at that point as well. And so, it's worked out well for us, and it's something that the students are asking for. And they want to remain.
And they're not living in single rooms side by side. They tend to be, if they're in a single room, they're in part of a suite. Mm-hmm. So they have a common living area, you know, a sort of living room type, and then they can go into their bedrooms to study or do what they want to do. So there's not a lack of social interaction because of the changing nature of the residence halls. It's just that they come out of homes where they had their own bedrooms. They very likely could have had their own bathroom, and that's part of their expectation when they go off to college.
Interesting. I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier, Nikki, the equation of state funding versus tuition versus the expense load of running the university. You said that over the past several years, the amount of state funding per student is about $4,000 less than it was. So what's happening? How is that being made up? And Tim, you might have some insight in this as well, but Nikki, why don't we start with you?
Well, part of it is being made up for by increases in tuition, but I can tell you that if I look at the combined tuition per student that's generated, along with the state support that's generated, we are basically, and just for inflation, we actually are generating less total support per student with a combination of tuition and state support than we were 10 years ago. So we have become, in many ways, what you would call more efficient. We're about 25% more efficient, which has both an upside and a downside. So it likely means that we have more students in classrooms. Faculty members are teaching more. So that means that there's a challenge for faculty to maintain the quality. But it also means that we've got to do other kinds of things more efficiently. And so Tim would tell you, we haven't given any increase to budgets on our campuses for things like supplies and travel and those kinds of things over the past 10 years. We've tried to be more efficient in how we buy our goods and services that we use to support the academic mission. And we're continually trying to do things more efficiently and effectively. We've tried to lower our utility costs by instituting energy efficiency. So we're constantly looking to reduce costs. And then there's some things that we just avoid the cost on. We invest less, have invested less to some extent in the ongoing maintenance and repair of our buildings in order to keep the cost down for students.
Right. And at what point do you start cutting bone instead of just cutting away at the sort of fat and meat?
I think we're at the bone right now. I would also add that one of the ways that we've been able to balance, the way I look at it, there's several ways that we've balanced the budget with the lack of state support. One is we have not invested in our infrastructure, as Nikki said. We have increased tuition modestly, quite frankly. We've increased enrollment quite a bit. But one of the other things that we're not so proud of, but we've had to do it, is we have fallen behind in faculty salaries, and that's not a cost cut. It's just not keeping up. and to the point that our faculty salaries are at the bottom of the AAU publics, which is our formal peer group here at MU. And so that's not a cost cutting, but it's just not keeping up with the cost, and that's how we've been able to balance a budget. Now, you can't keep going to the well on those. You can't keep deferring faculty salaries, deferring maintenance. There's a limit to how large the enrollment can be, okay? And there's certainly a limit, and Senate Bill 389 limits us to how much we can charge our students for tuition as well.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, faculty put in a lot of education, but they get paid fairly well compared to the parents of a lot of students. So the question that comes up a lot is, why is that a problem if faculty are not getting raises or getting continuing increases in salary? Because they seem to be getting paid plenty from a lot of people's vantage point.
Well, this is kind of a crass example, but you could say the same thing about football coaches too, I suppose. But there's a lesson there. We compete in the marketplace for the talent on this campus, and especially for faculty. We're a Research One AAU university, and so we are competing with schools that are much better funded than we are. And we're competing not just with other publics like University of Illinois, Ohio State, Colorado. We are competing with Washington University in St. Louis. We're competing with Northwestern in Chicago for those faculty. And so and you have to pay what the market commands for that kind of talent.
Well, and I would add to that is that our faculty that we're trying to recruit here are not being paid just to teach students. That's an important part of what they do, but another part of what they do is the research and economic development missions that the university has. So the faculty members that we want to hire, that we want to recruit and retain here at the university, are faculty members who can add to the knowledge economy of the state and of the nation, who can help us solve problems that will better people's lives. And so the kind of investment that we want to make in faculty, they will return manyfold back to the public and back to the state. But we're competing for those faculty members, and for us to be successful in those other missions, we have to be able to recruit the top faculty members.
Right. And is that a hard sell to a parent to say, hey, look, your student has to pay a fair amount of tuition here because we need this research to go on in our state?
I don't think so, because what we've seen over the years, and Tim can confirm this, let me tell you that 90% of the FTE, full-time equivalent increase in enrollment in the state of Missouri over the last 10 years has been in the University of Missouri System 4 campuses, and a big percentage of that has been on our Columbia campus. So I think students and families understand the value that they get from being at a research university, and they want that. And they also understand that we are a heck of a lot more less expensive than a private institution that delivers the same mission.
Terry, what do you say to that?
Well, we could probably stack up the cost, and it probably would be a lot closer than most people would think. When you talk about tuition, usually at a private school, because we don't have to worry about the subsidy and dividing up the fees and the tuition, we just roll ours all into one. So if you're talking about athletic fees or health care fees, activity fees, they're all in the tuition. So it's all there. We aren't a research institution. We are teaching and learning. That's our mission, and that's what we do. So the faculty that we are going after is a different set of faculty than what you might have here at the University of Missouri. There is no research program going on with us. So they're in the classroom, they are teaching, but it is very competitive for those. So I think, just like he was saying, you have to be competitive in that market to keep the quality faculty at your institution, and that's what you want to do. So you have to pay those faculty. And the efficiencies that was talking about earlier, that's how you keep the cost down, by being more efficient. And we've got, I mentioned before, an online program that helps us be more efficient with our nationwide campuses that we have, that help fund the operational expenses that we have for Columbia College as a whole. If I've got students at 6 or 7 campuses and I can only have 4 or 5 students that maybe want an upper-level business class, I can pay a faculty member to teach those 4 or 5 classes with 4 or 5 students in it, or I can have all those students take an online class, so now I've got 25 students in a single class with a single faculty member teaching delivering the same course and content.
Okay, let me remind everyone once more, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about why college keeps getting more expensive and what potentially could be done about it. Joining me in the studio are Nikki Krawitz, Vice President for Finance and Administration at the University of Missouri System, Tim Rooney, former Budget Director at MU, and Terry Donaldson, Assistant Vice President for Enrollment Management at Columbia College. For those of you in our audience, how have increasing college costs affected you? And do you have ideas for what could be done about it? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org, or you can also join our online chat room by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. I want to continue on this faculty thing real quickly. Just one other aspect of this. Keeping the cost of faculty down brings up the idea of adjunct faculty, right? And this becomes an issue in both a plus and a minus, right? So, Terry, you were just talking about keeping the cost down from faculty and maximizing the resources. How much are you relying on adjunct faculty who are obviously a less expensive solution from full-time benefit employees?
I think extensively. We probably have about 70 full-time faculty that teach here at the Columbia campus, but probably have another 3,000 adjunct faculty that are on our books. Now, they're not teaching all the time, any given session, and we run 5 8-week sessions a year. Any given session, we might have somewhere between 1,200 and 1,400 adjunct faculty that are teaching, very qualified, teaching the same program that's been written, developed here by the full-time faculty, and the approvals for those faculty members, they go through an approval process that's done here by the full-time faculty. But you can imagine if I can't really hire a full-time faculty to teach, let's say, an upper-level business class that I'm only teaching at a small campus every other year, a full-time faculty member to do that is just not a very good business model. So I may hire that adjunct faculty once every 2 years to teach an 8-week session, and then I might have another one across the country in California that's teaching the same 8-week session. Now, I may also have an adjunct faculty member that's teaching English Comp 1, and they would be teaching every session. So they're on 8-week contracts. It's not a full-time thing, but we're not using them all the time. It really is meeting the need of the student in the program at that location.
And how is it playing out in the at MU and the other system campuses?
Adjuncts are an important component of the whole academic scheme, if you will, here. And, you know, I defer to Provost Foster when we talk about these things generally. And what he points out is that that we needn't apologize for the adjunct faculty. And, in fact, there is in some cases, some of the adjuncts are absolutely marvelous teachers, okay? And he would tell you that we have some tenure-track faculty who are world renowned that maybe instruction isn't their strong suit. And so they complement each other in many cases in the departments. There are different strengths by these different faculty, and the adjuncts, by and large, bring strength to the teaching mission of the campus. But I wanted to get back to one other thing where mm-hmm. you're talking about parents wondering about, you know, the faculty and whether they appreciate the fact that we've recruited world-renowned faculty. Is it worth paying more for? Here at MU, since 2001, our enrollment has increased 47%. So students and families are voting with their feet, in a sense. And a major part of that growth has come from Illinois and Texas, okay? University of Illinois has a capped enrollment, so does the University of Texas. There are very qualified students in those states that are looking for a quality Research One flagship type experience. And they find the University of Missouri very attractive. It's a day's drive. But we can bring to the table the type of faculty and the type of academic experience that they're looking for that may not be available to them in their home states.
Right. I want to bring in a comment that we got in our chat room here, somewhat related to the sort of student demand. This is the comment. It says, college costs are growing explosively due to the immense amount of easy money in the form of cheap or subsidized loans, accompanied by the fact that virtually nothing is paid by the consumer, the student, at the point of sale. This is an issue that I've seen in comments on other stories related to this topic where, you know, this question of how much of the increase in college is because students are able to get easy money to pay for it, and they're not paying huge amount of attention to the cost that they're paying right off the bat. Because, you know, the college looks really good, the amenities look good, it's got a good reputation, they're getting the financing. And so, you know, it's a little more expensive than they might want, but, you know, it's all sorted out and they don't realize how much they're taking on until much later. Would you say that's contributing here?
I don't know if that's contributing or not. I try to think about it this way. On average, students who graduate, first of all, from the University of Missouri, from three of our four campuses, graduate with a lower loan balance at the end, debt outstanding when they graduate, than nationally is the case. So we're talking about in the $20,000 to $22,000.
So that's the average amount of loan
that's the average amount for a student who has a loan.
Right.
For a student, not all students borrow money, but for those that borrow, that's the average
amount. $20,000 to $22,000.
Right. How many students graduate from college and the first thing they do is they go out and they buy a car? And they're willing to pay off the car, you know, that in 10 years probably won't be worth $22,000. So I maintain that a student who has $20,000 to $22,000 in loan, if that's what they have to have in order to get an education, that's what they have to take out, is well worth the investment. Because the payoff in the long term is going to be higher salaries over their lifetime. And if they're diligent about paying off the loan when they get out of college instead of buying other things, that it's not unreasonable to expect them to be able to pay that off. Mm-hmm. Students and the other thing I would say is that students don't have to borrow money to go to college. So there are lots of options for students to get a college education without borrowing. So maybe that speaks to your point.
What are those options?
Well, they can start out by going to a community college and keep their costs really low. They can go to a college and live at home and not incur the expenses that are involved in that. They can come without a car. They can forego having an iPhone and an iPad for which they're paying. So I think there are a lot of costs.
And work on campus.
We
spend $50 million a year here at MU on student wages. And again, as I mentioned earlier, studies have proven that students that work on campus do better academically.
Right.
So we try to make as many of those opportunities available as we can.
Let me just real quickly, do you know the percentage of students that graduate with debt at MU?
I don't know.
Okay. Tim, do you know that?
No, I sure don't.
Okay. I'm just curious on that number. But Terry, real quick, we're going to have to cut to a break soon. But
sure.
What's the average debt load for a student with debt coming out of Columbia College?
Well, it's hard to define. But, I mean, our recent numbers have said about $3,000. But I think that's really that's a little hard to really say it is that way because you've got all these students that are the adult learners and our costs to go to those are much fewer. And we've got 25% of our students are military, and so they're being funded by their military tuition assistance. So if you start averaging that in and you get $3,000, it's really a different kind of picture. But I think you're not giving a lot of credit to the parents of the 18 to 22-year-old students. They understand this going into debt and those kind of things. And I think they're very savvy as far as not letting the students get too out of control with some of the loans that they'll take on. But you have working on campus obviously works. Scholarships obviously pays a lot for our students at Columbia College. So there are lots of different ways to help with those tuition costs.
Okay. Let me remind everyone again that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about why college costs continue to rise and what might be able to be done about that. Joining me in the studio are Nikki Krawitz, Vice President for Finance and Administration at the University of Missouri System, Tim Rooney, former Budget Director at MU, and Terry Donaldson, Assistant Vice President for Enrollment Management at Columbia College. For those of you in our audience, in the second half of today's program, you can be part of the conversation by giving us a call, 573-882-8925. We're going to take a short break, but we hope that you'll stick around, and we'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we are talking about what's driving the increase in costs of a college education. Joining me in the studio are Nikki Krawitz, Vice President for Finance and Administration at the University of Missouri System, Tim Rooney, former Budget Director at MU, and Terry Donaldson, Assistant Vice President for Enrollment Management at Columbia College. For those of you in our audience, do you think there are areas where colleges and universities could cut costs without sacrificing quality? If so, what are those areas? We'd love to hear your ideas. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. Again, you can also email us at intersection@kbia.org or go online to kbia.org, follow the link for Intersection, and drop into our online chat and get your comments to us that way. We were talking a little bit before the break about loans and how that the access to those kinds of loans influences student behavior and whether that drives up the cost. A comment in our chat room, you know, it talks about this idea, kind of hammering this idea of easy money. It says, well, if it were easy for students to get subsidized loans on cars that had low interest rates, that had easy payoff terms, they'd probably buy even more expensive cars, right? What do you think of that? I mean, in terms of this consideration, because there are a lot of people who really think this has been a driver of the increasing cost. The easy flow of money and supply and demand would just dictate that demand would go up for and people would pay more.
But that suggests that we are increasing costs because students have the ability to pay. And what I would tell you is that every time we increase the tuition to the university, and as an aside, let me say that our tuition increases on average over the last 5 years have been around the 2.4% average annual increase compared to the surrounding higher education institutions in the contiguous states where it's been more like 6% per annum. So we do a really good job at the University of Missouri in terms of trying to keep our tuition increases down. And at the same time, every time we increase tuition, we dedicate a portion of any new revenue toward financial aid. So our financial aid has grown over the past 5 to 10 years in order to help students who can't afford to attend. And just to give you as an example, we talk about the sticker price. So if our sticker price, which it is for next year, will be about $9,500 for tuition and required fees, the average price that a student pays, average cost that a student will incur, will be about $4,500. And if you look at students who are low income, so from families whose family income is $40,000 a year or less, they will pay about $2,500 on average for tuition and required fees. So I guess what I'm saying is that it's a great value. Students have to exercise some control over what other expenditures they incur outside of tuition and required fees. And I would suggest to you that sometimes they're not exercising the control that they should exercise.
Well, let me ask you this, because you've been on the inside of this part. Every year you have to, you, Nikki, and other administrators have to go to the state and say, we'd like to raise tuition by X amount, and you have to negotiate that out. How do you figure out where exactly you're going to start when you go down there and ask for a tuition increase?
Okay, so first of all, we don't have to ask for a tuition increase from the state. Our board of curators has the authority under the Constitution to make decisions about tuition increases.
So, the board of curators then can decide it without legislative oversight.
Absolutely. So what happens is that we start to build a budget each year, and we look at what are the marginal costs that we have, the mandatory costs, so things like increases in utilities, increases in the cost of the information technology that we have to keep our institutions running, benefit costs for our employees, and then some modest increase in salaries. Usually we're talking in the 2 to 3% increase range. And that's not based on cost of living. It's in order to have some funds in order to do merit increases. So we begin there, looking at what are the new costs that we're going to incur, and then we look at what revenues would we generate from either a projected increase in state support, and or increases in gifts or increases in other revenues. And then an inflationary increase in tuition. So we always start with an inflationary increase in tuition. And in the past few years, we actually had negotiated with the with the governor to not have any inflationary increase, and so we started with zero increase. And so what will typically happen is that the increase in costs, these mandatory costs, will exceed the increase in those revenues that we know we can get. And so then what we have to do is either figure out ways to cut costs or to increase other revenues. Sometimes we'll do it through modest increases in tuition, and sometimes we always do it through decreases in costs. We're always looking for ways to decrease costs, and then we'll do it either with additional modest increases in tuition or some kind of special fee, or we'll look for increases in gifts or other things that would allow us to make up the difference. But we don't start with the increase in tuition. We start with these other things and then say, okay, how much can families afford and how much is reasonable to increase tuition if we want to maintain the quality education that we deliver?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting in terms of projecting those costs out because, I mean, I know from myself and other people employed by the university here that, for example, faculty do not get an automatic cost of living adjustment. That's not ever factored in that. So in terms of determining those costs, I mean, how do you determine which ones have to go up and which ones are going to be held steady over time, even if tuition is not increased to the full extent that it could be?
Yeah, well, we start with what we think are really truly mandatory costs, and there are those of us that would argue that an increase in salaries is a mandatory cost increase, but we start first with typically the benefit costs are mandatory if we're going to maintain the benefit at the same level, and as you know, healthcare costs have gone up, pension costs have gone up, so we know that we have those kinds of increases, and so we start with those, and then we say in order to recruit and retain the faculty that we need to attract to this institution, then we've got to do some kind of salary increase if we're going to be competitive. Otherwise, we're going to lose those faculty.
Right. The process is negotiable. Just as Nikki said, there was a negotiation with the governor about the tuition. Same thing goes with our costs. We start off with 2-3% salary increase for faculty and staff. We may have to bring that down to 1% or something like that. Same thing with the benefit costs. The benefit costs may be going up 10%. Well, we can't afford a 10% increase, so we may increase the deductibles or the co-pays on the medical plan. In recent years, we've asked for employees to begin contributing to the pension plan as opposed to just laying all the cost, you know, out on the table and saying, state, take care of this. Well, they're not going to. We can't increase tuition, so we have to come up with unique, different ways that we haven't done in the past of balancing the budget.
Right. Terry, are there similar issues in terms of what Columbia College faces as a private institution?
They're similar in the instances that we have to worry about the benefits. We have to worry about salaries for the staff, for the employees, for the faculty, keeping them happy, meaning keeping them retaining them, because you invest something in someone for 2 or 3 years, you get them all trained up in the areas that they're become an expert in, and then they leave. So you got to stay competitive in that area. We're not getting the subsidy, so we have to find the efficiencies and determine the expenses that we're going to have. The leadership that we currently have at Columbia College has been very good about making sure that we are not continually incurring debt. So we make sure before we do something, we have the money to pay for it already, that sort of thing. So it's a lot of strategic long-range planning. I think one of the things that we've done with our campus here is fixed rate tuition. So a student that comes in, a freshman that comes in, knows what the tuition is going to be. That tuition stays fixed for 5 years. So the family can now plan for the next 5 years. They know nothing's going to go up for that student for the next 5 years. So they're able to budget for that. So that's helpful. We believe we're only in our second year of doing that. So we really have to see how that is, but it seems to be very attractive to our students, and the parents has been very favorable with the parents.
Right. I want to talk about some other things that factor in here. So technology. How much is technology helping the financial situation versus hurting it? I mean, the investment in technology obviously is considerable, but there's also potential gains there in terms of cutting costs. How is that playing out?
Well, technology is pervasive throughout the organization. So it's, you need technology to do what you do here at the Donald Reynolds Journalism Institute.
Right, just to put out the show, there's a lot of technology.
Right, there's a lot of technology, and you know how quickly that technology becomes outdated, the equipment. So you have that kind of technology. We have technology that supports our information systems. We have technology that supports our laboratories. And then we have the technology that's in, embedded in our instruction and is becoming more and more embedded in the instruction. I think, as Terry yes. pointed out, the potential for online learning to use it both in a hybrid way for students who to scale class on-campus classes and use it to, in some cases, to teach better, to have better outcomes, and in other cases, to use it for those individuals who are place-bound and want asynchronous learning opportunities to be able to learn at any time of the day or night. So I think the there is an ongoing need to invest in technology and that we are just beginning to see the benefits from that investment. But we've got to continue to invest. And in some cases, we haven't invested enough. If you look at the laboratories on our campuses and the state that those laboratories are in, many of those laboratories are in dire need of investment. And that, to me, is technology.
Right. Tim, your thoughts on this in terms of the investment at MU?
Nick, you said exactly what I was going to say. I mean, we can all talk about, well, the price of computers is coming down and this and all that sort of thing. But being a research institution, a research one institution, and also a major healthcare provider as well, the technology and the type of equipment that we need to do the work we do, whether it's the research in the laboratories, as Nikki referenced, or over in the Health Sciences Center, the modern life-saving equipment that's needed there. But it's also needed to train our medical students over there as well. And so it's not just for patient care, it's also for instruction. And those things turn over all the time. I mean, just, you know, CT scans, MRIs, PET scanners, on and on and on and on and so forth. And the technology there is just is at a lightning pace. It's just, it changes all the time. And we have to stay up with it if we're going to be the teaching institution we want to be.
Right. And what about the potential cost savings? I mean, Terry, you mentioned online education is a big piece of what Columbia College does.
It's a cost savings because you're more efficient. I think sometimes there's a myth out there that it's just cheaper to do stuff online, but it's not really true. But you can be more efficient, and with the efficiency comes the cost savings. But even the online, with some of the regulations that have changed in recent years, where just 5 or 6 years ago, when I first got to Columbia College, I only had to get approvals to operate in eight or nine different states that we were actually had a campus in. Now I have to get approval to operate in all 50 states to deliver courses. So where before it was a part of my job, now we have six people dedicated to getting those approvals. So those kind of costs comes up, but it's associated with the technology of delivering online education nationwide or worldwide. But what you get with that, with the benefit there is when a student wants, like he said, wants to take a class anytime, anywhere, their degree completion is not hindered. They can continue to do it. We have students that are over in Iraq, Afghanistan, taking their classes when they're not pulled in their duty shift. So they're not slowing down their education, and it's technology that allows us to do those kinds of things and deliver a better product to those students.
And is there a lot of that happening at the UM system?
Well, I think if you're following what's happening in the newspaper, I think you'll see that the system and each of our campuses is making large investments in online education. And I think that it's a mistake to think that it's a low-cost option to develop it, because I was just at a meeting the other day of the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities, and one of their vice presidents who works in online education commented that to really do a good job of developing an online course can cost you $1 million.
For one course.
To develop the course. But then you should be able to scale that in a way that you can't scale in-class teaching. Because once it's developed, it's then usable for large, large numbers of students and by large numbers of faculty members.
And how far can it be scaled? I mean, if you think about the cost of one individual class, I mean, how many of those individual classes add up to $1 million? I mean, where, at what point does it become an actual cost savings as opposed to being a huge outlay at the beginning?
Well, most of us aren't spending $1 million to develop one course.
Of course.
So I would say
yeah,
that to start with. So it scales up much faster than that. I think it depends on the class, but if you read the statistics about the number of people that are signing on to take MOOCs or to do those kinds of...
Those kind of massive online...
Massive, yeah.
Learning communities is whatever they call it. MOOC stands
right.
for basically an online course that anyone can take, right?
That's right. And so if you think about the fact that you have that potential to be able to do that, it can have great efficiencies and pay off in the long run. Most institutions aren't developing those courses in order to make millions of dollars, although it has the potential to be able to do that. They're really doing it as a way to meet both the president and probably the governor of every state in the union's challenge to increase the number of citizens with post-secondary education credentials. Because it's very clear that we can't do it all with on-campus learning, and so we've got to use the other tools that are available to us, and online learning is an important tool.
And are state governments talking about funding these things, aside from the money that they're giving to the institutions, or are institutions supposed to cut out of what they're already spending in order to come up with these million-dollar per course development costs?
Well, again, I don't want to overstate. I gave the $1 million as an example, so I don't
want
to put it out there that that's what it's all going to cost.
Right, fair enough.
But I do think that we're expected as higher education institutions to make the decisions about where we should make strategic investments. And those strategic investments are around what our goals are in terms of educating the state's citizens, and how we go about doing that. And so we have a responsibility to make investments in those kinds of things. It would be very helpful if the state helped us to do that by increasing the support to higher education. But in the absence of that, we have to look for to other ways to do that. And we have been doing that.
But I think the president has come out and says that he expects the burden of higher education to be less on taxpayers in the future and is looking to the institutions, both public and private, to find a ways to lower education cost. So we have to look at those ways because if you read the writing on the wall, there's probably going to be less subsidy in the future. I mean, it's not going to increase, we do not believe.
Right.
So we have to plan on that.
Would you agree with that the amount of public funding for education is going to continue to decline?
I think right now it looks that way, and I think that's an unfortunate state of affairs. And I think it is maybe related to our inability to help the public to understand that an investment in education is an investment for the country as a whole. It's probably the best investment that anyone can make in terms of the return that it gives both to the economy as a whole. States that have a higher percentage of citizens who have post-secondary certification or degrees have higher incomes, which have higher income tax, which means that they have more to spend on education and other things that improve the quality of life for the citizens in that state. So that's a known fact.
And where does Missouri fall? Where does Missouri fall in comparison to other states on some of these metrics?
Missouri has as a goal to increase the number of citizens with post-secondary degrees and certification. So I don't know exactly. They've given some grades out recently, and I want to say we're maybe in the C range, you know, maybe mm-hmm. average nationally. But we need to do better.
And in terms of per student spending. Per capita spending, how do they do that statistic?
So there are a number of different statistics that are used to gauge what the level of investment that states are making in higher education. And two of those is higher education funding per capita being the number of the population in the state, mm-hmm. and higher education funding per $1,000 of personal income. And unfortunately, Missouri is usually ranks somewhere between 42nd and 47th in those two metrics, indicating that we don't provide as much funding for higher education as perhaps we should.
Right. Okay. Once again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about why college education keeps getting more expensive. Joining me in the studio are Nikki Krawitz, Vice President for Finance and Administration at the University of Missouri System, Tim Rooney, former Budget Director at MU, and Terry Donaldson, Assistant Vice President for Enrollment Management at Columbia College. For those of you in our audience, we have a few minutes left if you'd like to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org or go online to kbia.org. Follow the link for Intersection, and you can join our online chat room and watch our video that's feeding through there right now. We talked a little bit about healthcare costs and providing that for faculty. How is the Affordable Care Act going to affect the finances of our state institutions and also private colleges like Columbia College? Let's start with you, Nikki, on the state level.
Well, we're in the process of studying that so that we understand it more fully. We know right off the bat that it's going to impact the benefits that we offer to our part-time faculty members, and how we define those part-time faculty members will be critical in terms of the additional costs that we have to incur with regard to providing health care for those as a benefit to those faculty members.
Mm-hmm. See, we're in the interesting position of being a consumer of health care and a provider of health care. And so one side, it may be advantageous, and the other side, not so advantageous. And so from a consumer standpoint, we have to provide additional benefits, perhaps. And I'm not that familiar with it, but Nikki, sounds like for part-time faculty and staff, we may have to. There may be some costs that we haven't had to absorb in the future. But on the other side, the University Health Sciences Center, the health system, could be a beneficiary of this in some fashion. But when I retired a couple of months ago, as of that point, it was not totally clear how those numbers are going to really play out in the long run.
Right. Terry, what about Columbia
College? I would
agree.
We have the same issue, meaning we're concerned about where it's heading. But what we really have is a lot of questions. We're in a fact-finding mode to really find out how things are going to be defined. As I mentioned before, the majority of our students and our majority of our operations are on 8-week sessions, which means they're accelerated from the standpoint that you complete a course in 8 weeks. So if an adjunct member is teaching a 3-credit-hour course, normally that's over 16 weeks. Well, they're spending twice as much time in the classroom over that 8-week period. So a student going full-time takes 2 classes as opposed to 4. So you can imagine if it's all based on weekly kind of terminology, it doesn't take very long to get to the 30 hours that they're talking about, depending on what kind of multiplying factor they use. If it's 3 times the number of credit hours, but does that really apply to us, or is it really 6 times the number of credit hours for us since we're in an 8-week session as opposed to a 16-week, which is it's just a different model, and we still have to find out what those answers are going to be. But at some point, somebody somewhere, this is going to change, and there's going to be a cost increase somewhere, and then somehow you've got to figure out how you're going to address that cost increase.
There's I want to switch gears a little bit. A question from our chat room came in, and Tim, I'm going to start with you on this one. Where are areas of waste in a university?
Well, it's sort of like beauty. It's in the eyes of the beholder, I suppose. I can't identify a place right now where I'd say this is a waste. It's a trite saying. We've picked the low-hanging fruit. We've already done that. And I think the fact that we are part of a system gives us some economies that the system has seized upon, like purchasing. You could talk more about that. Certainly the treasury function, where we commingle all of our funds together. And our good bond rating allows us to have access to money at a much lower cost than other places do. Are there still places that we can?
Well.
Yeah. Are there still places where some cost savings can be had? I'm sure there are. Okay, and we mine those areas, and each manager, each department chair, each dean is looking for that each year. And it gets back to what we talked about earlier in this conversation, that we are distributing no money really to the units for non-salary items, whether it be technology or travel or supplies, equipment, all that sort of thing. And so the departments have to find a way to fund that themselves. And so they cut staff in areas they can, cannibalize those salary positions, and use them to fund their other expenses because they're not getting any new money. So a lot of this cost-saving activity happens at a very low level, and it's not very noticeable because it's done at that level. But in the aggregate, it amounts to quite a bit.
Well, let me ask you this. What happens when you get past the low-hanging fruit, right? Because, I mean, we've seen examples of how hard it is to eliminate programs at a public institution,
yes,
right? I mean, there have
exactly.
been several things that the university press is one of them. There are other academic departments that, it just seems like it's impossible to ever reduce the amount of offerings at a university like this. Is that true, or are there ways to
I think it is true. It's very difficult to, particularly an academic program. There are some studies out there says you don't reap any savings for 5 or 10 years once you close an academic program if it has tenured faculty involved in it, and you have students in the pipeline that you want to allow to finish their degree. So it is terribly difficult. And I know that the chancellor, certainly the president of the system, and each of the four chancellors are really engaged in that kind of thought process right now, and they're developing new strategic plans. And again, I'm out of the loop on this because these are relatively new things that are going on in the last couple of months, that we're going to have to look at a new business model. Now, I'm not sure what that is exactly, because there isn't one out there that you can just, at least that I've seen, you can't say, oh, you know what, University of Michigan's got the business model. Let's go up there and see what they're doing, just copy that. We're all kind of in the same boat.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, from your vantage point, as someone who dealt with this for years and now has the freedom to think about it without having to be dealing with it every day, what would you like to see changed in terms of that business model question? I mean, what?
I think, you know, this wouldn't be a popular decision, but I think we should be free to charge what the market will bear on our tuition, okay, without government interference, Senate Bill 389, okay?
I can hear parents screaming.
No, I know. I understand it. But even further, by discipline, perhaps, or by college, different colleges charging different rates of tuition. We have that to some degree with the supplemental fees.
Yeah.
But perhaps in a more formal basis, in a more broad basis, and look at what the market demand is, what the starting salary is in a particular discipline going, and charge the tuition for that particular area based on those sort of things as opposed to one tuition for the entire institution.
Interesting. Nikki, any other ideas for how the business model could be reshaped to help solve some of this stuff?
I think we have to look at this is also – this would be very unpopular, more unpopular than what Tim is suggesting.
Say that now that I'm not employed.
Right. I do think that we have to look at and I'll use this term very loosely, faculty productivity. I do think we have to look at how do we deliver courses, how do faculty spend their time. And I'm not suggesting that in saying that faculty on average aren't spending their time well and productively. But I think that we need to look at that more closely and decide from an institutional perspective what's in the best interest of the institution in terms of how faculty are spending their time and make some of the hard decisions. You know, when you ask the question about, well, could we eliminate programs, there's an assumption that we have programs that aren't fully used. In other words, that there's a lot of excess capacity in a lot of our academic programs, and if we just got rid of that excess capacity, then we would be more efficient and we wouldn't need as many faculty members. I would suggest to you that in this day and age, after the past 10 years, that there's very little of that left. On the other hand, I think we have a large number of faculty who might be better off spending their time teaching a class rather than doing something else that they're currently doing. And so we've had a sort of standard load of a faculty member teaches two classes a semester, and maybe there should be some faculty members who teach three and some who teach four and some that teach none.
We're going to have to stop there. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I'd like to thank our guests today, Nikki Krawitz, Vice President for Finance and Administration at the University of Missouri System, Tim Rooney, former Budget Director at MU, and Terry Donaldson, Assistant Vice President for Enrollment Management at Columbia College. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that our program takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. That's the time to call in and to join our online discussion at kbia.org. Just follow the link for Intersection and you'll find our chat room, you'll find our video feed, you'll also find the archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project for RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar, Travis McMillan, our technical director, Pat Akers, our audio producer. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.